It sort of fits with our discussion of near-death experiences. We've talked about it many times on the program, the nature of these experiences, how it follows a familiar pattern, going into the light, meeting loved ones. It's generally a transformative experience, a positive experience. At least we've heard that over and over. Nancy Evans Bush has written a new book called Dancing Past the Dark, in which she says there are a heck of a lot of these experiences that are, as she expresses it, distressing. Distressing near-death experiences, and it's a fascinating book. We pick up the conversation with our guest, Nancy Evans Bush, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. In the preface to the book we're going to discuss for the next 2 hours, Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's of the University of Virginia School of Medicine, expresses it this way. He says, although this book was written by a person who's had a distressing near-death experience, it is not by any means a book just for them. This is a book for anyone who aspires to face the totality of the world in which we live. All of us have experiences for which we're unprepared. All of us at one point or another face frightening or distressing experiences, and all of us sooner or later need to master the art of dancing past the dark. And that's the title, Dancing Past the Dark, Distressing Near-Death Experiences by Nancy Evans Bush. Nancy, it's great to have you on the program.
Thanks so much.
Let's start it this way. Long before you were studying this on an academic level, you had the experience. Tell us the story.
The experience itself happened when I was 28. I was in labor with my second baby, and actually I was in active delivery, and in the custom of the time, I was anesthetized. And the next thing I knew, I was flying over what I took to, well, I was flying over a roof. And then I realized it must be the hospital roof because I could see buildings around it, and one of them was the school in which I was teaching. And then as I kept flying, it wasn't exactly flying, it was just like shooting into space. And I could slowly see the dim. It was midnight, but I could see the dark shapes of the landscape, and eventually I could see the curvature of the earth. Now, this was way back in the very early 60s, before we were so accustomed to seeing pictures of the earth from space, and it was very exciting because I remember thinking, oh, it's true, it really is round, because I could see the earth. And I just kept going into space, and at some point, moving towards me, there were some circles. They were simply round, black and white circles, and they were clicking black to white, white to black. And they had a message. Now, this was not a verbal message in words, but it was just thought to thought, telepathic. And the message was, you don't exist, and you never did exist. It's all been a joke. Your life was a joke. Earth was a joke. You were allowed to believe it was real, but it never was real. And this is what there is, just this big empty space. And I was arguing with them passionately, trying to come up with all the proofs I could think of that would confirm my existence. I had memories. I could recite facts about geology and my mother's childhood And how could I know these things if they weren't real? I had a baby at home, a toddler. She was real. And it was simply, no, none of this was real. It was a joke. I was permitted to believe it, but it never existed. And then the circles moved away, and I was out there, wherever out there, however out there might be defined. And what struck me particularly was, why didn't God show up? Because if I was out there, wasn't God supposed to be out there? And it was just me.
Did you think at the time you were dead?
I'm sorry. We have a not very good connection from my end here.
Okay, I'll ask it slower. Did you think at the time that you were dead? Did it occur to you that you had died?
No. It never occurred to me that I was dead because I was thinking. And my assumption was that if you're thinking, you're not dead. It never occurred to me when I woke up that I had been dead for the same reason. I did think when I die, that's what it will be like. But it never occurred to me that I had been dead.
In your experience, did you have any of the other kinds of things that are described by in the typical NDE where you see a loved one or you go into...
Elements of the experience actually parallel quite closely the essential elements of any near-death experience. There's the typical out-of-body experience. There is movement through a dark space. There is encounter with entities. There are messages. And back in the early days of near-death research, Kenneth Ring at the University of Connecticut devised what he called a weighted core index scale, experiencer index scale. And on his scale, if you achieved a score of, I believe it was 7, you had a genuine near-death experience. If you, with a score of 11, it was a core experience. And I tested my own experience against his index and came up with a score of 17. So clearly, although the emotional elements of the experience are not those of the radiant, blissful experience, the core constituents are the same type of element. And this is pretty common across distressing experiences.
Distressing is one way to put it. Depressing is another way. I would think that whoever these entities were that were telling you it's all a joke, it was kind of cruel. And I'm wondering, when you came back, did you share the experience with your family? Did you tell loved ones about it?
I did not share this experience. I attempted once to talk to my husband about it, but it was such a devastating experience, both emotionally, psychologically, theologically, that it just seemed like too much grief to put onto another person, especially. I mean, if you love somebody, you don't want to say, oh, honey, let me tell you what's really out there. That it's not the heaven you've heard about. It's this annihilation. So I did not say anything about it to anyone for 20-some years. And my interpretation was, well, essentially the only thing I could come up with coming out of a Protestant background was that Calvin was right and that predestination actually exists, and that I was on the wrong side. Predestination, meaning the idea that God has predetermined before we're even born whether we will be saved or not. And clearly, I was on the wrong side of that equation. So it was, well, I have said a couple of times in lectures that to call these distressing is kind of like saying that a woman in childbirth is experiencing discomfort. They are typically shattering experiences that take an enormous amount of work to come to terms with.
And Nancy, let's jump forward, and then we'll get into some specifics about what some of this might mean. As you mentioned, you had this experience in the early 60s, and it's many years later that you find yourself in a position to study near-death experiences, to evaluate them in a clinical setting, in an academic sort of setting. That's a heck of a coincidence, or is it?
Well, coincidence is, of course, the common word. It has felt as if I've been on assignment. I struggled for 20 years trying to come to some terms with the experience. And then after, at a particularly difficult time in my life, I was out of work, everything had fallen apart, and suddenly there was this tiny ad in the newspaper for a part-time temporary job at this little startup nonprofit that I had never heard of. I'd never heard of near-death experience. But I was hired as office manager for this little bit of a scrap of an organization. And it took about 3 weeks for me to realize that there was a name for that experience I'd had. And yet the only other experiences anyone was talking about were the radiant ones. So I thought, well, maybe it was just me. But I was answering the phones in the office and opening the mail, and every once in a while there would be a letter or a phone call that would say something like, "You people aren't telling the whole truth. There are other kinds of experience. I had one, and it wasn't blissful." Or, as very rarely, but someone would say, "I died and went to hell." And I realized that I was not the only one to have had a difficult time with this kind of experience. And out of that came this determination that somebody had to find something to say to people who had the dark experiences. Because otherwise it was just heavenly realms, and that wasn't the whole story. Now, obviously, that presents some very real difficulties, particularly for those of us who theologically weren't at all sure what to believe about doctrines of hell. And that's essentially why it took so long to get the book written.
Well, you jump into the deep end of the pool right off the bat. You quote Albert Einstein talking about his famous remark that the most important question facing humankind is the universe a friendly place or not? And you note, science really can't provide a friendly universe, but it can provide a description of what is observed. Now, looking back on all of the research, let's say in a general sense, is the universe a friendly place or not?
I think the universe is both a friendly and a potentially unfriendly face. Essentially, I think friendly is a very human way of wanting to define it. But what has really undergirded my work for these past 30 years is the recognition that any of us, no matter who we are, the scientists, the theologians, the plumbers, the school teachers, the talk show radio hosts, the people at the other end of their phone, we are all sharing the same universe, and we're all looking out at it and saying, where are we? How does this place work? Which is, of course, what people have said since they first climbed down out of the trees and began roaming the savannas of the ancient world. Where are we? Are we safe here? And the answer is both yes and no. If we look from our vantage point today as a humble people, we had seen those pictures of the most distant space science can show us. And it's both glorious and terrifying. It isn't either or, it's both and. Some parts of it are peaceful and serene. Other parts are explosive and generative. Other parts of it, as in dark holes, are terrifyingly, apparently annihilating everything that comes into their field.
Nancy Evans Bush, author of Dancing Past the Dark. The music tells us we're taking a break. When we come back, we'll get into some specifics about stories you've heard of other distressing near-death experiences. Stay with us, everyone. Coast to Coast AM continues. The near-death experience, as we've heard on the program in previous interviews, goes to the heart of who we are, why we're here, what comes next, central to the human experience in this lifetime on this planet. Nancy Evans Bush is looking at it from a different perspective, distressing near-death experiences and what they might teach us about the big questions. We continue our conversation with some examples from her research right after this on Coast to Coast AM. To recap so far, Nancy Evans Bush had her own near-death experience, not all that pleasant. It's what she calls a distressing NDE of her own in the early 60s, and years later, coincidentally or not, finds herself working for a program, a research program, looking at near-death experiences. And as she examines the letters that come in and the reports and phone calls, she finds out that she's not the only one who had a distressing near-death experience. Nancy, can you describe for me, if there were 10, in a sample of 10 NDEs, how many might be negative as yours was? Not necessarily negative, but distressing.
The best information we've got is that perhaps as many as 1 in 5. So out of 10 near-death experiences, possibly 2 would be either entirely distressing or at least in part frightening. Now, to say that they're frightening does not mean that they all involve actual perceptions of hell, because essentially they fall into 3 categories. Some experiences that terrify people, really, if you just look at their elements, sound exactly like the same things people describe of the most pleasant experiences. Again, out-of-body experience, the floating through space or shooting through space, encounters with the landscape, with entities. But they're, in their case, even though the landscape may be beautiful, the out-of-body experience may be pleasant, the entities may be family members and friends who have died previously, the experiencers are terrified because the whole thing seems so out of control. The kind of thing about which people say, I was shooting out of my body, and I thought, I'm not supposed to be out here. I'm supposed to be back in my body. What am I doing here? This isn't right. And things move too fast. They're too unexpected. It's as if, well, put yourself in the position of a person who has such an experience, and all of a sudden, instead of sitting wherever you're sitting right this minute, you're 20 feet above yourself looking down, and you see yourself, but nobody can hear you. Nobody pays any attention to you. There's just your body is doing whatever it's doing, completely independently of your observation. And this sense of being so out of control and powerless is a very, very frightening experience for many people. Now, other people may have a very similar out-of-body experience and think, as one young woman said, she was just ecstatic. Isn't this fun? Look, I'm flying. It's like Peter Pan. I'm flying.
I would think so. Yeah, I would think so.
A lot of the emotional response depends on the person who's having the experience and how they interpret it. So there's that type which has all the descriptive elements of a positive, really great experience, except that the person experiences it as disorienting and just not the way things are supposed to be done. So there's that type. Then there is the experience like mine, which in which really the bulk of the experience involves being in a featureless void. Now, for someone who is, say, a Buddhist, who is accustomed to the concept of, say, nirvana, of an emptiness that is not really empty, but that's featureless, this is an understandable, or at least an acceptable, idea. For those of us in the West, from a Judeo-Christian historical tradition, everything we know from the time we are tiny involves objects and relationships. So to find ourselves in a what appears to be totally empty space, even if it contains all potentialities, the difficulty here, you see, is that potentialities aren't necessarily visible yet. They're still only potential. So there seems to be nothing there. And those of us who are Westerners typically see this as being either obliterated ourselves, or we are simply lost. If you think of the song Lost in the Stars, except that even the stars aren't there. So that's a second kind of terrifying experience. And the third type of distressing NDE is the least common, and that's the one that has, in which people define it as being hell-like. And that can be hot, it can be cold, it can have a bleak landscape, typically bleak landscape. It can involve entities, but the ones I have heard described most frequently are not what we see in pictures from Dante's Inferno. It's not little demons with arrow-barbed tails and pitchforks. What the experiences I have heard have involved mostly seeing kind of shadowy, somber-looking people at a distance. If there are people close by, they very frequently, their faces are either obscured or they are faceless, which would be pretty scary all by itself. But they're not so much physically menacing as they are just psychologically menacing. There's a sense of just inherent terror to the whole experience.
Nancy, you make the point in the book that pretty much everyone who has a near-death experience, whether it's a positive or negative, distressing or not, so many of those people come back and their lives are transformed. You reference the work of Kenneth Ring, who talks about this, how it gives them a renewed sense of purpose and a new interest in life, and like a shot of adrenaline in the arm. Did that happen to you?
It's absolutely true that a person after a really powerful near-death experience, whether it's the good kind or the difficult kind, is typically never the same. You really can't come home again, because what these experiences do, George, is they give people not just theoretically but experientially the very clear understanding that there is more than the physical world that is real. Now, we tend to say, oh yes, I know there's more, but until a person has actually experienced the more, it makes a huge difference. Now, people who have the pleasant near-death experiences commonly come back with those things that have become so well known in the culture: unconditional love, a life of service. They lose some of their materialism, and it all sounds wonderful. Those experiences, the blissful, pleasant type, are, in my terms, the heights of spiritual experience. The distressing experiences are the depths of spiritual experience. And what one comes back with is the necessity to confront the deepest corners of what it means to be and how one lives satisfactorily with an understanding of suffering. Now, this does not sound like much of a gift.
I don't know. I would have to disagree with you. I think that is an incredible gift. I mean, it sort of goes to the heart of who we are and why we're here, isn't it?
Well, that's the point. It goes so deeply to the heart of why we're here that it's extremely tough to get hold of, because for the most part, those of us who have these experiences, we don't come into them as, you know, academics, as theologians, as philosophers. We come into them as perfectly ordinary people who maybe have had some kind of religious background, maybe not. We may be convinced atheists, in which case, as Ken Ring has said for so many years, there's a real problem. Because an atheist doesn't know what it was they encountered. They just know it wasn't supposed to be there. So people come to these experiences from such a range of ordinary backgrounds and then somehow have to try to make sense of them, which is easy to do, or easier to do, if you say, oh, that was wonderful, God really loves me, and I really believe that God does exist, and now I see what my life's purpose is. But after a distressing experience, some folks, particularly if they have certainly if they've had a hellish experience, they are very likely to try to find a solution in one of the really strongly doctrinal religious traditions. Do this, do that. And if you follow these rules, if you believe these things, you'll be safe. So for that group of people, they may not lose their fear, but at least they find a way to explain it. And then there's another group of people who, after a distressing experience, will say, well, I don't really need to pay too much attention because it was only lack of oxygen. Somebody has told me that these experiences don't really have any meaning. It's just a physiological response. Well, here too, they are left with their fear. They just slap some kind of biological label on it and say, well, there, that's that, all tidied up. But it doesn't really ever get to the heart, as you say, of what is this experience about? So then there's the third group that sets out like what Harry Potter on a quest to say, we have to get to the bottom of this. And that can take a lifetime.
Like you.
Yeah. I'm seriously hoping that as we bring these experiences out into the light of day a little bit more, and then people get more comfortable talking about their experiences, that we can come to some language other than the language of the medieval hell. Because frankly, however one interprets it theologically, I think that particular body of language is most unhelpful.
It seems, Nancy, like the experiencers, it's like everything else in life. You get out of it what you put into it. Depending on the baggage that you take into it, an NDE determines what you see, what you feel, and how you react to it once you come back.
Certainly. I think for the almost all cases, I think it's not possible to come out of an experience and interpret it in any concept you didn't have when you went in. Which sounds like a really clumsy way of saying that the only language in which we can try to explain an experience is language we already have. Nobody comes back from an experience with a little bag of new nouns. So, for example,
Before you get into that example, Nancy, this music tells us we're taking a break. I want to ask you something on the other side, because you told us in the beginning that you had this message that it's all a joke, it's not real, it's been a dream, kind of a cruel message. But you're not the only one to get that message. Some of the cases you list in the book, the folks got the same message. We'll get into that and then open up the phone lines with Nancy Evans-Bush, author of Dancing Past the Dark, right after this on Coast to Coast.